Lipsky. And once again, thanks for the opportunity to present us our work. With our, I mean my collaborator, Sabrina Nagel, she did a master's thesis in our lab, and she's now at the City College, Imperial College in London. Dan Goldman, he's now a postdoc in Berkeley. And above all, Harry Swinney, who provides a terrific work environment. Then you go into the middle of the field, it's about granular temperatures and various granular kinetic temperatures. And the one you're all very familiar with, the kinetic granular temperature, it's the average kinetic energy of the random motion of the particles. And you see here a simulation of about 2,000 particles vertically shaken. And the color coding corresponds to that kinetic temperature in there. And you see there's a shock wave traveling through the bulk of the sample. And this is a very inhomogeneous and temporal and spatial relation of the situation. So this is the normal kind of temperature people are speaking about. And actually, you can do quite a lot of it. You can, for example, do a hydrodynamic description of the things going on here. That was done by Jenkins and Richmond, below a lot of other people. And what you see here is a comparison of one phase of the shaking. The red line corresponds to the temperature, the blue line corresponds to the density, and the dots is the data taken from the molecular dynamic simulation, and the continuous lines is that hydrodynamic description. And you see that there's very nice agreement between those two theories, so you can really do quite a lot with that in terms of granular gases or granular fluids.
But
I don't want to go into that simulation, and this reference was done by John Bougie in our group, and I'm the wrong person to ask about that. But in most of this talk will be now related to static granular media. And by static, I mean that there's no motion going on other to the specific time events. We want to explore configurations of granular media. Here's a sketch of three different configurations of grains piled up to each other. And you can think about that as a phase space of different configurations. And if you want to now move around in that phase space, you have to do it manually. You have to expand the sample, that's because of the latency. And after expanding it, you have to come settle it down to a new configuration. That means the kinetic energy will only be non-zero in a phase where you inject the energy, and afterwards it will dissipate out. And the rest of the talk is mainly concerned about that flat periods here and how to sample this configuration in phase space. If you want to do that, and if you want to go for some type of statistical mechanics, you actually have to assure ergodicity at some time. That means all those mechanically stable configuration of grains, they should be probed without any prejudice or something. They should have the same chance to occur in the experiment. And to do that, or to prove that in experiment, is really difficult. But what you can prove is that you have history independence. That means that the sample state does not depend on the way you prepared it. The sample doesn't remember how it was set up. And that is at least a necessary condition for ergodicity. It's not a proof that you are ergodic, but if you don't have history independence, you probably have not to go on. These ideas were first pioneered by Edwards and Oakeshott in about 15 years ago, and most of this talk is basically in his spirit. Especially over this slide, where he kind of came up with an analog for granular statistical mechanics compared to the classical statistical mechanics. The microstates now are the number of mechanical stable or jammed configurations to fill a given number of particles in a given volume. You can, in principle, at least count this number and build an entropy in the usual way. Then he says, well, the interesting extensive variable is actually not the energy, because in static granular media there's no kinetic energy, there's nothing going on, but the volume. And now you take the derivative of this volume with respect to that so defined entropy, and you come up with a temperature measure, which he calls compactivity. And we think we have now a way to measure that compactivity without knowing actually the entropy. I should not go on without mentioning that there's other granular temperatures which might be of interest. There's a lot of work done in fluctuation dissipation temperatures. I think the first experiments were done by Dana et al. He took a torsion pendulum and took it in vibrated sand and find a nice temperature in that way. Recently there was a publication by Maxi, who took a Taylor Quad apparatus, sheared it, and watched the up and downwards motion of slightly density mismatched tracer particles, and got mobility and viscosities out of that. And there's also work going on in a lot of other groups, like for example in Paris, where they drag a bead through a tickled, kind of tickled granular bed, and I'm sure I'm missing a lot of here. I mean, there was also a talk last week by Kondich about a generalized granular temperature, which not includes also elastic energies into the kinetic energy, and looks how these terms together would work out. And if I have time, I will come back to that point at the end of the talk. So what were we doing now differently than most other groups? Well, we have another way of driving. We use a fluidized bed. And a fluidized bed is actually just a fancy name for kind of a glass column, where you have a kind of a filter at the bottom, which is called distributor, which keeps the beads from falling out. On top of that, there's a sample of glass beads. And then you press water from below through the whole thing. And for explaining how fluidized bed works, you in principle only need Darcy's law. So the flow rate through the sample is proportional to the permeability of the sample and the pressure difference between the bottom and the top of the sample. So what happens if you now increase the flow rate? First, the sample will just sit there and be constant. The permeability is then constant, but the height of the bed won't change, but the pressure drop will increase with increasing flow rates. But at some point, which is the onset of fluidization, the pressure drop over the bed will actually equal the buoyant weight of the bed. So if you now increase further the flow rate, there is no way to increase the pressure further. The pressure stays constant, and the bed has to expand. The permeability goes down. This is a regime where we actually do our experiments. We apply flow rates where we expand the bed into a certain height and use that effect. Any question? Okay. So this is a little bit more detail. We actually drive the bed with a syringe pump, which allows us a very precise control of the flow we put into that, especially in terms of flow rate. And we monitor the height of the bed with two cameras within an angle of 90 degrees and detect very precisely the height of the bed in that way. So from these measurements, yeah, the typical measurement looks like that. You have a switch on the flow for a certain time, tau pulse, and the bed starts to expand till it reaches a certain height, if you're in particle diameters or if you prefer in volume fraction, and it stays there as long as the pulse goes on. At some point, if you stop the pulse, the bed sediments and collapses to a new height, and after some waiting time, this is highly really constant, we check that with the spectral measurements, so there's no motion going on. And now, after this waiting time, we take images of the bed and determine the height now very precisely, and that's all I'm going to show from now on, is these heights of sedimented beds. The main claim we make is that these sedimented beds are basically static granular piles with slightly changed density contrast because the interstitial fluid is now water instead of air, but there's no flow going on, and there's also no air-water interface or something. The whole sample is all the time underwater. There's no liquid bridges or something between those things. So it's just a granular pile sitting there. So the main results we have are these. This is now, we give the bed 800 flow pulses and see how the height of the bed changes. The different colors correspond to different flow rates of the flow pulse itself. And here again you see the bed height, or more interestingly probably the volume fraction. And you start all those experiments with a volume fraction of 0.581, and up to a flow rate of about 27 milliliter, the bed relaxes with the very first pulse already to its final flow packing fraction. So it's a very quick relaxation. It takes longer if you go to slower flow rate. The overall volume of the pump is limited, it's 30 milliliters. So the flow, we took the pulse time to be, we extended the pulse time the lower we took the flow rate. So all the time the bed is actually flown through by a total volume of 30 milliliters. So what to do with that data? First, we really have kind of a stationary state, and the remaining fluctuations you see, you can see if you look very closely, that for example the pinkish line has some slightly bend in there. The remaining fluctuations you see here are inversely proportional to our temperature change we have in the experiment. We can only control the temperature to plus minus 0.1 Kelvin in that setup. It was actually never built for temperature stabilization. And the viscosity change is about 2% at around room temperature per degree Kelvin. So these small changes in viscosity actually influence us strongly enough to make that slightly bends in there. And this will be later important if we discuss what else experiments could be done with that setup. But other from that, we have a nice stationary state. So stationary state is only part of the story. I already told you, if you want to go for some hydrodynamics, you have to make sure that you actually are at least history independent. For that purpose, we run a special protocol we tap the pad with 50 flow pulses of a certain flow rate here, 60 milliliters, then we decrease the flow rate, gave it another 50 pulses, and so on. So we came down to 23 milliliters, and we increased the flow rate again 50 pulses. And now we take the average height of the way up and the way down, so to speak, and compare those. And if the bed is history independent, it should not remember it if it's coming from a higher or from a lower flow rate. It should go to the same average packing fraction and avoiding fraction. That's what you see here. The open dots correspond to increasing the flow rate, the closed dots to decreasing the flow rate, and the remaining differences are again correlated with the temperature fluctuation. This whole experiment did run over 36 hours, and that's just the best we can do right now. There is a fit into that in that plot, and this is a purely phenomenological equation. There's no reason or no work in literature or no theory why it should look like that. It's just giving the best fit. But this will allow you to kind of extrapolate where your random loose packing would be. Remember you, the paper by Onoda and Lineger, the first one who actually really did measure random loose packing with high accuracy, they did two setups, and one of them was actually very slowly let the grain sediment in a long cylinder. And this is kind of the same thing we do here. If we go to very high flow rates, we expand the bed a lot, and it takes quite some long time to sediment. So for infinite flow rate, you would expect to go to random loose packing. And from that fit, we can kind of determine where that random loose packing for this given density contrast would be. Yeah?
I think you said that you saw a dependence cell on the viscosity.
Yeah.
So that these numbers will change with the viscosity of the...
These numbers will change with viscosity because... Let me explain that. It depends actually on the height where you start with. And if you have a different viscosity, you kind of expand the bed differently. These curves you're speaking about are predicting how the expanded bed would be. But I think nobody has really looked systematically at where the sedimented bed is after you expanded it. I mean, I might be wrong with that, and I stand corrected for that, but I spoke to people, for example, I spoke to Goldstein, who does shocks and the sedimentation, and he did not have references on that. But I'm happy to learn more about it. But there's a lot of theories about expanded bed. I think nobody did pulse beds. I think the fluidized beds and engineering community, they have not a big interest in pulsing a fluidized bed. They expand it.
Actually, there is.
Okay, I stand corrected.
People look at pulse bed for totally different reasons. Some have bubble stability, but most look at one. And
bubble stability is for this is a completely different regime of where we are.
Yes, but I look at pulse bed.
Okay.
I may have some references because we did experiment this by Brittle.
Okay, I'd be happy to learn more about this issue.
Why do you expect that the loose pack state, what you obtain after this transition, would be the same loose pack state which you obtain, for example, by vibration or something like that? It could be totally different.
Oh no, I'm speaking about a random loose pack state. The most loose configuration you can pack the piles, pile the grains under their own gravity for that given density contrast. Maybe there's a fundamental misunderstanding, but the way we drive it, I mean, it's very expanded. So the loose state is actually set up if the particles kind of impinge on the bottom. If you want to look at that, how that loose state is actually built, you have to focus in on that last moment when the particles actually really touch the particles lying under low below it. And there's no flow going on there. This is a pure sedimentation problem.
There is no flow, but even one particle sediment, they interact.
Yeah. Okay, so what is your point? You think that this is not the most loose configuration you could get? Oh yeah, there might be a couple of different loose configurations, but the point I want to make is that in principle I can sample all of them with this method. Yeah. These particles are 250 micrometers plus minus 5%. We don't see any crystallization in there. Okay, I want to use that random loose packing value in a second. That's the reason basically why I put in this kind of question with Phil. So the fluctuations themselves around that average value, you can see focus on that. Well, 800 data points don't make a good statistic, and especially if you have that, you have to look for good runs where you have small temperature variations during your run. But everything we can say right now is that they are well described by Gaussian, at least in what we have in our data. So we assume that Gaussian fluctuations is, at least in the first approximation, a good thing to assume. So if you now take those Gaussian fits, you get a standard deviation from them.
Sorry, can you give a feel for how, what's the difference in band heights and grade variables?
Yeah.
Corresponds with Gaussian widths?
You see, particle bed height and particle diameter is really, really small. Really.
So we're looking at
this small. It's a very tiny fraction of particle, and I can go into technical aspects of that, but that's basically the reason why we have two cameras in there and look for the correlation of the two camera thickness, because one camera could easily get fooled by a tilting motion of the surface. But if you look at two cameras and see how they change synchronously, you get a very much, it would be a very funny tilting motion that does that all the time. So there's a lot of technical things going into making sure that we really measure those fluctuations to the accuracy we claim to have. So the standard deviation of that fluctuation, of that Gaussian, is now plotted as a function of the volume fraction. And that curve might be surprising at first because, why should we have a minimum? Actually, you can fit it very well by a parabola. And again, there's not really an explanation for that, but we think we have kind of an argument why you actually should expect something along those lines. And this goes back to classical statistical mechanics, where you learn that the relative fluctuations of any extended variable, if they're is proportional to the over the square root of the number of statistically independent regions. So the question which arises now is, what are the statistically independent regions in those samples? And actually, you can do a little bit better if you go to this paper from the Chicago group. They actually estimated the proportional factor you have in here with a very simple argument, just saying if you look at one statistically independent region, if n is equals 1, the fluctuations you can have are actually somewhere between random loose packing and crystal. So that gives you a 0.2 as an approximate first value to put in here. You can probably argue a lot about it, but for ballpark value, it's probably correct. So we have to go on from here now and ask ourselves, what are the number of statistically independent regions we have, or how many particles actually belong to one of those statistically independent regions we have for a given packing fraction? And if you now plot the number of these particles, we know the overall number of particles we have in there, we can calculate the number of statistically independent regions, so we get the numbers of particles per region, which is plotted here with that equation, it gives this curve. And let's start at random loose packing. Random loose packing is the most fragile thing you can set up. So some people refer to it as isostatic state. There will definitely be a lot of structures which are bridges or arcs in there. And if you start removing one of the particles in those bridges, you'll actually get the local collapse. A lot of other particles will rely on that particle and will fall down. So you kind of set up a local avalanche. The size of this local avalanche will decrease the more you increase the volume fraction. So this is why this curve is going down. But at a minimum, another effect kicks in. The free volume remaining in the sample becomes much more scarce and scarcer, and at some point you just can't move a single particle alone. You have to start moving two particles or even bigger groups of particles to kind of redistribute the free volume, and going up to random close packing or maximum random jammed, as some people refer to it, you probably have to move the whole sample to actually still move something. So this is kind of our explanation why there should be a minimum right in there, and you have to expect it, kind of. So what are we doing now with those values? Well, we try to measure the compactivity. And again, we take another thing suggested in this paper by the Chicago group. They said, well, in classical thermodynamics, you can look at the heat capacity, it's derivative of the energy. respect to temperature, and that's proportional to the energy fluctuation squared over kdT squared, which is a fluctuation dissipation theory. So now, just by replacing everything to analog to the ideas of Edwards, you would end up with this equation where you have the average volume with respect to the derivative with respect to the compactivity is like proportional to the volume fluctuation squared. And doing a little algebra, you end up with this equation. You have to solve an integral which requires you to know the volume fluctuation as a function of the average volume fraction, and you start a random loose packing. I mean, these are the values, but we all just kind of got out of it. We put in here the parabolic fit I showed you, and we start from the random loose packing value we determine from the curve. We average the whole bed. Yeah, we are not on a, and I'm coming to that, we are not on a per particle level. That will be an interesting twist of the story and will be coming in a second. There's just traveling wave instabilities for certain. We don't see signatures of that. We think we are in a regime where we even don't have traveling waves. We're not expanding a lot. Our most expanded bed is like 52% packing fraction. This is a good question. Yeah. This is a good question. We don't know that. We assume right now that the changes in height are not at least constant. They're not changing a lot with the volume fraction. We have no local measurements, and we try to do something along those lines with a more sensitive, locally sensitive volume fraction measurement. But this is an open question, I agree.
You could do it for different fillings of the cell. Have you done that?
Would be another option. No, we have not done that. But we think we have a powerful laser, and we want to look at the extinction in different heights with photon detectors and see how that kind of scales with different heights. Yeah. I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, this is very important to do those experiments in liquid fluidized bed and not in gas fluidized bed. Okay, so now here it is. The first compactivity ever measured as a function of the volume fraction. It's not that you learn an awful lot by looking at that curve. Actually, I will show you in a couple of seconds that we're even not sure if we did measure the right thing. But at least it's a kind of a starting point. We now can go on and say, well, we have a thermometer. We can go ahead and measure Edwards compactivity in some way for the materials and see how what is it doing. Yes, how do we actually know that we're not measuring some peculiarity of the apparatus? Actually, a side effect brought us on that, or proves that kind of. In the beginning, we had terrible problems of reproducing our results. And this went on for quite a while, and then it became better and better. And we checked for everything, like biological contamination of the water and temperature stabilization, all the kind of things. What we found out is if we put the beads under a scanning electron microscope, and now this is a really very close up of the beads. The beads are 250 microns and these are 2 microns, so we're really big focusing in. You see that those new glass beads have a lot of surface flakes and asperities on them. And after a couple of flow poles, you can see where they wear, but they get sheared off, they get washed off. The beads become smoother, the surface friction properties change. And actually this change in surface friction properties kinds of gives you a different parabola. So the blue curve is what I just showed you before. The red points are 24 dots because we did only short experiments started with really new beads from the manufacturer, and the minimum is shifted to lower volume fractions, which gives sense because if you think a little bit in more frictional beads, the onset of collective motion will be lower in terms of volume fractions, and more random configurations will be mechanically stable. So your random loose packing value and also your minimum will move to lower volume fractions with more frictional beads.
Change the water?
No, this is actually the same water. The water is going through a 0.2 micrometer millipore filter. The water is, there's chemical stuff in there to make sure there's no algae growing. We have ultraviolet lamps in there to make sure that there's no biological contamination. I really did a lot of things to make sure that it is not an issue. From that new glass beads, we get another compactivity curve. But again, this is not really very enlightening to have now two of those curves. I mean, it's not, you expect that if the fluctuations are different.
And the random loose pack is different.
The random loose pack is also going to lower values, yeah.
theory, but of course they have spirit.
Yeah.
And now your spirit, they do change with time.
Yeah.
And so, so the trajectory understands the frictional quote unquote properties of the Godhead. Isn't that so trivial?
Definitely not, yeah. I agree.
It might be more direct trajectory that have like ball bearings that are.
Yeah, but
but
then you have the problem of really big density contrast, and then you get much easier in that bubbling regimes. Ball bearings, steel ball bearings or something with a density contrast, it would be much bigger, and then you kind of more easily move into the B regime. So we don't want to increase that too much. But you're right, it would be very interesting to do it with something really small. Acrylic would be, yeah. Yeah, we're definitely going to have, we're right now redoing the experiments of other stuff, and we just moved to our first, I mean, there's a lot of, we have big parameter space now, but we decided to first move on to other diameters. But definitely other materials are on the list of what to do. Okay, so compactivity is measured, so what? I want to use the rest of this talk to try to present first results and also other people's work on four questions. First is, did we actually measure compactivity the right way? There's another suggestion how it should be measured, and we're going to come to that in a second. Then, I mean, just by measuring something out of those fluctuations, we have not proven anything about how right or wrong is Edwards with his hypothesis that you can actually build a thermodynamics on that sort of things. Also, a physical parameter is only considered of value, for at least for a lot of people, it has actually some predictive capabilities, and that's something to look into. And finally, what is the relation between that compactivity and the other granite temperatures I was mentioning in the beginning? Let me start with the first thing. So Edwards himself recently published something where he looked at a confocal microscopy images of colloids. They did it with a high resolution, and now they can go ahead to find the standard of those particles, they know the radii, and they can now partition the volume in a specific way. They actually came up with their own way, they didn't use one of the standard ways. They look at something like the first coordination shell of each particle. Actually, this partitioning scheme is quite peculiar. It, for example, doesn't conserve the overall volume. It's slightly different than the overall volume of the sample. But doing that, you can come up with a volume distribution. And now he says, well, this is the Boltzmann distribution. You just have the compactivity down here and that exponential decay you will find in your experiment. And he finds that exponential decay here in his specific sample, and he gives a value of 119 micrometers cubed over lambda. This is this parameter analog to the Boltzmann constant. So this is the compactivity of the sample. Lambda is the analog to KB, if you're in that. Yeah, so in that way, probably lambda would not have any dimension, I agree. No, if the conductivity has a dimension of a volume and okay. Actually, people have done, now this is not a completely new type of measurement because people have done that also for granular material, and I'm thankful to Tommaso Esti, which allowed me to use some data of his recent preprint. They have done it in Canberra down there with a very high resolution X-ray tomography. And they had six different samples, they prepared them with different ways, tapping and stuff, but it is global, quite a bit of a volume fraction region you can have. And they now go for only a subpart inside the sample, which is far away from all the boundaries, and they do different tessellations to find the volume distribution there. And one of those is the so-called Delaunay tessellation, or where you look at the pore volume inside there. And if you look at that in a log scale, you will find that those decays are very nice exponential. And you can actually consider that as then as a Ke or lambda times x over the volume fraction. However, if you go to other ways of partitioning the volume, for example, to the more standard Voronoi tessellation, you find different distribution and different decay, and even these Voronoi decays are also not that nice anymore in terms of being an exponential decay. And especially your KEX values are now on a different curve than the ones you would find for the Delaunay termination, which opens the question, which is the right way of partitioning those volume into smaller sub-partitions? Yeah.
What would be the difference?
Both of them are space-filling, I think.
What's the difference in the
Delaunay? The Delaunay is basically centered around the pores, while the Voronoi tessellation is centered around the centers of the particles. And also both of those curves are very different in terms of compared to the compactivity as a function of volume fraction I was showing you. These are linear scales here, while ours was on stretching over many orders of magnitude on a logarithmic scale. So only one of those two compact ways of determining the compactivity can be right. Actually, after discussing yesterday with David Dean, what I kind of learned from that discussion is that you maybe can reconcile those two approaches if you're not really looking at a partitioning scheme which works with the individual particles, but if you look at a partitioning scheme which looks at the statistically independent regions and study the volume fluctuations of those regions. This might be in a way to kind of reconcile it, but yeah, some people in the theoretic community have now to make up their mind which is the right thermometer for measuring compactivity. That's an open question, I know.
When it comes to none of these things, I don't think you can do local volume measurements, because you're trying, if the end result measure was correct, you should be able to actually do the calculation of these things again. You would see that presumably one of the volume distributions calculated in these two different ways, that you could find prefactors between the compactivities that we have. Because these things aren't independent.
Yeah.
If you actually wanted to start from this physical mechanical approach and actually compute these distributions, starting from the same Edwards measurement of assumed compactivity, you wouldn't expect these curves to be the same anyway.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, yeah.
In fact, having one thermodynamics and two observables, you don't need to coincide even if the underlying thermodynamics is the same.
Yeah, okay, so somehow this has to be reconciled, I mean, that.
What is the ratio?
The ratio is roughly 2. A little bit less.
Is it not the ratio?
No, I'm less concerned actually to be those two not being the same. I'm more concerned about the volume fluctuation of the whole sample versus the volume versus those, yeah.
Could you put up yours again just to see how the ranges compare and so on?
These colloids also have a very different mean diameter than our beads, so that this is now in millimeters and the other one was,
in fact, your volume fraction is actually even narrower range than
what my volume fraction is even a narrower range than what they have, yeah, definitely. So right now we're trying to collaborate with him on another group in Germany to kind of measure the same beads with both methods and kind of compare it directly experimentally. Okay, let's go to the second question. What about the underlying assumptions Edwards does? Is that correct? And there was two papers which suggested different ways of proving that. One of them was by Mario Nicodini and other people, and they have written a couple of papers. This one is a very nice write-up in a recent book they published. And what they actually did is they looked at how, there was actually a talk which is given here, so I'm kind of going very quickly to that. They looked at hard spheres on a lattice, and they introduced some tapping dynamics which consisted out of bringing those hard spheres in contact with a thermal bath with a temperature of T gamma for a given duration, tau, and then after that let the particles come down, relax again, and measure the average energy, the potential energy of the system, and do that a lot of times, and of that way also get the fluctuations. What they did show is that neither the temperature of the bath nor the pulse duration are good thermodynamic variables because they don't collapse the curves. But if you plot the energy fluctuation as a function of the average energy of the system itself, you get a nice collapse. So this would look like something we could also test in our experiment because we have two parameters, the pulse duration and the flow rate. So why don't we just go ahead and change a little bit around and see if our measured fluctuations fall on top of each other. This is not as easy due to the details of how we drive the bed. Actually, the pulse duration turns out to be a not good parameter for that time of test, because you want to make your pulse duration at least as long to reach that second state. If you stop earlier, you kind of depend on peculiarities of the expanding process. But once you have reached the fluidized expanded state, a longer waiting time will not change really what you find after sedimenting again. So for that reason, we kind of not really can reproduce that. It's just the difference between simulations and real experiments being more dirty. But it actually opened the idea, the way for thinking about it another way. We could do an even more radical test. I mean, if Edwards is right, those observed fluctuations should only not only be independent on the pulse duration stuff, it should be actually independent on the way we drive at all the bed. As long as we assure that we do a history-independent driving on, ergodic driving, we sample all the configurations we have, all types of driving should end up with the same fluctuation for a given volume fraction. But people with other ways of setup, shearing, horizontal shaking or stuff, should actually look again into those volume fluctuations, and then we could compare those and see if we really find the same volume fluctuations or not. This is a much more radical test, I think, than just varying parameters in one specific setup. There was another paper by David Dean, which says, well, let's look at the probability to find a certain energy or volume for a given set of driving parameters, and now compare two driving parameters, but look at the same energy or the same volume. And then this, the logarithm out of the quotient of that two should actually be only proportional to the energy itself. And the prefactors contain the compactivity. And this works nicely in a system of spins, where you did that. And again, we thought, again, that might be something we might be able to test. We just replace the energy by our measured volume, the two driving conditions by two different flow rates or two average volumes, and we could do that type of test and see if it actually scales linearly. But our system is too big. Our fluctuations are much too small to kind of meaningful overlap between different driving conditions. If we go to very close by driving conditions, then the temperature drift will mess up our results. We would have to go to a much smaller system to be able to do something which is really meaningful in that region. So again, this is something we cannot test right now with the way we have set up our bed, which is disappointing, I agree. Okay, but what about, what is compactivity actually good for? Well, the initial idea by Edwards and another paper by Mehta together is, well, it might be the control parameter of segregation. Imagine you have two types of particles, small and big particles in the same sample, and now you have a mixed state, put it in a lattice, and you have a segregated state where all the small particles go together and all the big particles go together, and you can map that on an Ising model. And then you find that if the compactivity is smaller than some critical compactivity, you have actually mixed, and higher you segregate. Well, this is a very rough approximation, and there's a lot of things going into that. There's a lot of more work, especially by the people in Napoli in the meantime. So, for example, there's a recent preprint where they look into that in more detail, and they find out, for example, that you probably would have to consider two different compactivities for the two different species and that stuff. But it might look as something you might want to test. Okay, I mean, for segregation, there's a lot of other mechanisms playing into that, and minimizing the potential energy in the gravitational field is definitely one of them, yeah. But that would mean, yeah, but okay, I could kind of spoil that argument by saying, well, I don't make those crystalline. I make them still random packed, and so then the gain of potential energy is not that big. I mean, if it's sampling or not, if the polydispersity is still big enough. Okay, I just want at that point just introduce the idea. This is ongoing work and we don't have results on that, let me say that right from the beginning. But I think it's something that could be tested. We want to test it in actually a two-dimensional system where we can really see how segregated the bed is. So here we have kind of a Hellishaw-like cell, here you see a side view of that. We fill in two types of Snellatron disks with a diameter ratio of 4:3, number ratio 1:1. And then we pulse this bed again, but this time with air. Would be much more convenient to do it with water. It would save us a lot of problems we have with air, but we recognized that too late after we set up the bed. So now we're going to work with that one and see how homogeneous we get the expansion and study that. What we do see is that the area fraction, fluctuates again as a function of the pulse duration and the pressure we give into the pulse. And we can do much longer runs because the pulses are now lower. But we have not systematically studied, for example, up to now, if the system really behaves history independent. That's what we're still about to find out. And also we have already programs in place which find the centers of mass of all the particles. Here the red spots correspond to big, blue to small particles. Now we can go ahead and characterize how segregated the bed is. This is the initial stages after 10,000 flow pulses. You already see that there's clusters of particles which are very slightly more segregated. And you can now look at contact numbers or local bond orientation order and stuff like that and really see what of those is a nice order parameter to measure your segregation. And then you compare that to what you learned from your fluctuations. And the idea is to see if in that three-dimensional phase space, so to speak, between area fraction, fluctuations and order parameters, if there is something really on a plane.
Well, according to the guess, you must have somehow the dynamic form of the system to the viscosity density and such, and you will, it's well known that these are very unstable systems, and so your fluctuations will depend to a great extent on the dynamics. You have the viscosity and density mentioned in the whole talk, and very surprising for difference.
You haven't seen.
You can expect very different fluctuations of the local volume fraction if you change the density and the viscosity of the fluid.
Yeah, but I mean the home point of Edwards is that actually the driving should not depend on the fluctuation should not depend on the driving. What is the problem that you don't believe?
Well, I don't believe that the dynamics.
Because the volume market has settled out. Well, yeah. Let me put a different spin on this, which is, I would think that the way it happens actually creates anisotropies in your system. And then what you end up with is something which is doing uniaxial compaction. And to put it slightly more positive on things, but what I would say is another state variable that you have. So I would drop
contact numbers to measure this. Which of itself, I agree.
The fact that you have uniaxial compression means the system is no longer random.
But as long as we don't go into space, you probably will not get rid of uniaxial compression of I mean, that's what put into this mechanically stable. In the beginning, Edwards spoke about mechanically stable, meaning able to sustain its own weight under gravity. And that is what he's sampling. He's really not looking at the whole phase space of possible configurations. Yeah, it has to be unbiased for all mechanically stable configuration. Right.
The question is whether these other parameters are causing a bias.
Yeah, and I mean the best we can prove that is say we are history independent. I mean if somebody has a better way of showing that what we could else do, but we definitely exclude all possible configurations which would be able in without gravity. That's not in the book right now. We're just speaking about mechanically stable supporting its own weight under gravity configurations, and they have to be equally sampled unbiased.
You're looking at a subset of all possible states.
Exactly.
And there's no reason why, in fact, you can see this in this expression, that you would get, say, the same compact ABs for different states, because they are different on the basis of the physical measurable properties, which just isn't put into the anisotropy of the network.
What I'm saying is like in your question thermodynamics, because you have a sample with or without magnetic field.
I completely agree with that. Now, all experiments we present are under the assumption we have gravity and it's anisotropic in that direction. Yeah, I mean, contact network will be definitely, force network will be definitely, but Yeah, again, I mean, shearing or horizontally shaking, the final state after it settles down will also be have the same anisotropy in horizontal direction.
But it could easily sample different sets, different regions of phase states, and that may well be the reason you're getting different temperatures comparing to
I mean, the way that Fitz set up the Tommaso acid, he set up the things was just by tapping it. And, I think the local volume distribution is so robust, you will not say that. I mean, this is something I cannot prove right now, but you will definitely not get something that far away from what we see. That different tapping to fluidizing will not explain the big difference in the compactivity values we have. I bet on that.
So you basically imagine that you could come up with a model where you would predict the mean volume fraction locally based on dynamics, and that you input the density and the viscosity of the fluid, you calculate the homogeneous expansion based perhaps on the balance between the sedimentation rate and the amount of flow that you have, or something like that. And then once you have the volume fraction, you would then predict this theory with the fluctuations that it would do? Is that what it is? Or do you know all physical parameters that have to do with dynamics? Like the mass, the viscosity, and the density.
You're worried about the state after it at all.
I'm interested actually really on only the only parameters which kind of go into my baking of the isotropy is the gravity or the rescale density contrast. I think if I would change that, I would definitely change my what I measure. I would also change it by surface properties. I mean, I'm really only concerned about the mechanically stable states. And the way I look at it is, and the way of bringing a system from one state to another state should, if Edwards is right, not matter. As long as we really sample unbiased. As we start sampling biased, then everything is off. I mean, then we're a completely different story.
Maybe one thing that's not so clear is that, if I understand it right, is that each state is totally static. There's no fluctuation in a given state. But then he refluidizes and then lets it fall, and then that's the fluctuation.
Yeah.
So during those plots that look like time plots, those are not time plots.
Yeah.
While it's flowing, the actual flow is off during all those points. But it's a new state that's been generated by heating it and then.
It changes the function of number of
fluidizations. So there's no flow going on during.
Yeah, sorry, I have not made that clear enough.
So what you had
as time was the time? No, the axis was a number of flow paths, like lifting the system and settling it down again. Sorry, I should have made that more clear. No, this is really, there's really no dynamic. We're really speaking about static, settled, mechanically stable cells.
But the way they settle depends on the viscosity and lots of other things, and that's where a bias could be in place. That is, if you settle them using a different method, then you may be sampling a different portion of phase space.
If that is the case, I mean, I can't prove that this is not a case, but if that's the case, then Edwards is definitely gone from the world.
No, it just means you're not sampling all the.
No, okay, but then you're right, but then somebody has to find a way to actually sample all the configuration. I mean, Edwards needs
to make the right thermometer.
Yeah, so someone has to really find the right way of putting energy into a system, but I think a fluidized bed is a very homogeneous way of putting energy system compared to everything else that is studied.
Just for example, I mean, when particles are sedimenting, there's a force to bring them together. And so you get these kissing and tumbling motions in these sedimentation places. That might give a bias toward pairs.
But
that's all I'm saying.
Yeah, no, I agree. But the way I see it is kind of that the really setup of the bed happens actually if there's the surface, and now the next particle comes down and finds his position where it stands down. Whatever happens in the way down is, in my understanding, just determine kind of a rate constant of the particles coming down.
Right, but if they come down in pairs versus coming down singularly,
there might be a bias. I agree. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's not that hard to do the test by just putting in, you know, putting withdrawal water.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can go for another viscosity.
If you have the same results, then you're not biasing. If you disagree, then you're biasing it, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you haven't filled it all out. You just have to understand what bias you throw it into.
Okay, but it would be the wrong system then to study adverse ideas. It depends on the viscosity.
You can report viscosity.
I did report this depends on how big is the bed expanded. But this does not but it does not influence the fluctuations. The fluctuations are very slowly changing kind of in packing fraction. The average packing fraction is sensitive to the viscosity. Yeah, and you would need a big change in viscosity to test that, yeah.
I have one last philosophical question.
Yeah.
Maybe it's back for discussion. But let's assume that you probe that there is thermodynamical description of gamma media. What are the implications?
Let's assume that I do what?
If you probe that there is kind of description directly. And what are the implications?
Okay, part of it would be, just give a quick answer, part of it would be that then you would have to next step prove that it's actually useful for something, like predicting segregation or something. I mean, you can define a lot of parameters which are just defined and sit there in a shelf and don't do anything useful for physics. So that would be the next question I would do again.
Before we go on, about the role of density of viscosity, perhaps it's a paper that I maybe don't know, where folks looked at sedimentation just to non-Brownian particles, I don't know how large or small they were. Remember, what they did is they progressively density matched the system. They looked at the final packing state.
That's the Onoda Lineager paper.
They reported to measure what they called random loose packing.
Yeah, that's the Onoda Lineager paper I was speaking about, yeah.
So the final state definitely depends on the density mismatch.
Exactly, and that's what we find out again. They have 250, that's the Onoda Lineager PRL like 15 years ago or something.
Yeah.
And what they find out is that a random loose packing depends on a density contrast. They have particles that have 250 micrometers, it's very similar polydispersity than we have. And if we plot our random loose packing value, we find on their graph, it fits right into the error bars. We are completely agreeing with that. So let me go on. And this is kind of a shaky thing because I'm not presenting other people's work, which are actually in the audience. So I don't want to lean out of the window too much, but let me see if I can get the main ideas across. So the last question we want to look at is actually what is the ratio between convectivity to those other granular temperatures that we're speaking about. And obviously the most interesting one is the kinetic temperature. And there we use some nice methods which is called spectral visibility spectroscopy from Heath's office. And what it relies on is you do the following. You have a sample, you come in with a laser beam, and light gets scattered in that sample, multiple times scattered. The sample is so dense that you can kind of make a diffusing approximation for the light paths in here. And then you look at the speckles with a CCD camera. So each of those speckles kind of integrates all the phases of all the different light paths in there. If I now move one of the particles, the length of that light path will change according to the phase of that light path change, and in the end, the intensity of the speckle changes. So the intensity fluctuations of one speckle, which are plotted here as the red line over time, kind of encode the motion of the scatterers inside the sample. You can do that with much more theory, and I'm not really the one to present that here, but if you do a couple of assumptions, you can go ahead and learn about the average motion of the particles in there. So now the nice idea about this is well-known older stuff. There's a lot of ways of testing speckle patterns. The nice new idea is now to actually look at the exposure time effect. If you take that red line and you now take a camera with a longer exposure time, the shutter is open for a longer time, so you integrate over a couple of points and you will move in your gray value to a more average gray value. And you will become more and more average the longer your exposure time is. So this is kind of shown here. These are all the pixels of my line scan camera. And the numbers here give you the length of the exposure time. And you see that the signal becomes more and more to an average level the longer the exposure time becomes. So the variance decreases with exposure time. What you now can do is you can have, if you have a higher time resolution of your time signal, you can actually synthetically calculate longer exposure times by just integrating over the time for each of those pixels. And if you do all the math, you learn something about the motion of the particles in there. And this is what we see in our fluidized bed. Let me explain it a little bit more detail. These are the line scan cameras, so here one row of these images corresponds to one instant in time. These are separated by 100 microseconds, so this is a time scan. Here you see the flow rate for the driving the bed with. What you see here is that the speckles, the white points, more or less stay constant in time. They are not moving a lot. They stay where they are, in space. And if I increase the flow rate, you see that the speckles kind of come in, but then fade away, so the dynamics becomes faster. And if you go higher the flow rate, even you can't really even distinguish a speckle as a single line. So now you can go ahead and calculate the variance along those lines as a function of different exposure times. And if you do that, I should have said in the beginning, we are now looking at a fluidized state. This is the state I was omitting all the time. We're now in a state where the bed is really expanded and there's flow going through it, and we're not looking at the sedimented state. In the sedimented state, obviously all the lines should be just straight lines because there's nothing going on in the sedimented state. The light paths don't change. That's our definition of mechanically stable, and we've checked that. So now we're kind of looking at how does the kinetic energy in a fluidized state depend on it, and how it might be related to the compactivity we find afterwards in the sedimented state. That's the issue we are right now. So now here you see in different colors for different flow rates the increase of normalized variance with time. And the black lines are the fits of the theoretically expected curves. All those fits have only one fit parameter, which is proportional to the kinetic granular temperature. And all the lines together have one fit parameter, which is a geometric factor and tells you how many pixels actually are in one, how many pixels you need for one speckle. But this factor is constant for all of those fits. So all the other ones have just these kinetic energy fit parameter. And you see that for higher flow rates for the expanded bed, we get a very nice agreement between theoretical expectation and really measured decay of variance. And now we can go ahead and plot this kinetic granular temperature of the fluidized expanded bed as a function of the volume fraction of the same fluidized expanded bed. That's what we get here. This is still up to an arbitrary unit because you have to determine, to actually give it in real units, you have to determine the path length inside the sample, the mean free path for the scatterers. We have not done that yet. This is where the preliminary results we have. This can be now compared to the compactivity of the sedimented bed after the fluidized, the bed is fluidized. And these are now on a logarithmic scale, and this is very different curves. And again, this is the first result, and we're not able to really make sense out of the connection between the fluidized and the sedimented state. But there's a lot of work going on between all those temperatures, and especially there's a lot of people looking into similarities between compactivity and the fluidization, fluctuation dissipation temperatures. There's a lot of theoretical work comparing those two with each other. And there's also some people interested in the dependency of fluctuation dissipation temperatures and kinetic temperatures. So now we have to kind of the two extreme ends of the scale. What misses is in the middle, the fluctuation dissipation temperature. And then we have all three together and can kind of see how things are related to each other. And let me close this talk with a fact that one of the nice features of spectral visibility spectroscopy is actually that it allows time reserve measurements. Here's our shutter time of 0.5 milliseconds. We can look at the variance for different flow rates, and you see that the variance of for high flow rates are pretty constant. This is for 30 and 50 milliliters. This is why we also believe that the fluidized state we see is actually not seeing any traveling waves or something. It's just a homogeneous expanded state. But if you go to low flow rates, you see that the dynamics becomes very intermittent and reminds maybe of any glassy or something transitions going on here. And I want to finish this talk with a slide I shamelessly adopted from a talk from Louis Condit, which said that actually the onset of those big fluctuations might mark the point where the kinetic temperature and the elastic energy stored in there kind of become equal, and that this might actually be the point we're going to see here in that low flow rate. So I want to summarize with fluidized beds, I really need tools to study granular material. we have now two competing types of thermometers for compactivity, and maybe we can reconcile them, maybe not. Then we have to make our mind which one we want. And a possible way to check the Edwards hypothesis would be to look at volume fluctuations with other ways of driving. Thank you for your attention. Kinetic energy fluctuation in liquid.
So, I mean, it's in the zero Reynolds number regime, it's talking that the velocity fluctuations in the sedimenting fluid are independent system size.
And then you mean that?
Because of the large, long range aerodynamic effect.
Yeah.
Not for particles which have a net force. For force free particles, yes.
So yeah.
You can get the
connection
to the back coefficient,
but part of the difficulty. We're trying to put it through the S-band right now. We're putting it together. We have already density matched the liquid with the particles. We're putting tracer particles in there, and that will allow us to see how what the statistics we kind of get in there. But I agree that this is an open issue.
Yeah, because it was a huge theoretical issue for a long time, and it's still not stable, whether it's system sense.
Numerology comment question.
Yeah.
A few years ago, we did some experimental gas fluidized beds.
Yeah.
A couple different particle sizes. We were looking for finite size effects. So we varied the filling fraction and the
mm-hmm. Yeah.
And our protocol for producing the final state was to slowly turn off the fluidization
yeah.
after highly fluidizing it.
Yeah.
And what we found was it always goes to a packing fraction 59.5.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah.
Which struck me as the point where your fluctuations are minimal.
I'm the wrong person to answer your question, but because I'm Dan Goldman, who's right now preparing a nice paper about especially those effects and about this minimum and how it might be related and what kind of class transition might be seen there, and I don't really want to talk about his work here, but you might want to write him an email and get in contact with him.
So it might be an interesting
yeah.
special state.
Yeah. That's definitely, we think that this minimum is actually a special state where there's some dynamic going on, or some change of dynamic going on in granular material in general, yeah.
But that minimum does depend on the age of the particles.
Yeah, yeah.
Here you go. No, well, it could still be, because you're going from frictional to smooth particles.
Yeah, I wasn't saying your thing depended on that, I was saying that number does depend on it.
Yeah.
So it would be different if you had new particles.
Because if you go from frictional to smooth particles, there's a static change, state change.
Sure, of course.
Yes, again, a parameter we have not studied yet. We could easily study now. We got another sample which was so bad in monodispersity. We kind of can go with that and start seeing. But no, we have not studied that yet. We also want to study how it depends on the size of particles. We already got that famous Ottawa sound to kind of see how it goes if you go away from spheres to more polygonal particles. There's a big parameter space which is open now to study.
Yes. Did you try to correlate the inverse temperature deduced from volume fluctuation with that which could be deduced from the by tracking the motion of grains between two shocks?
No, because the tracking of the motion of grains is not something we can do right now. No. We want to go for those fluctuation dissipation temperatures in the system, definitely. This is one of the next setups we will work on.
Questions,